The conversation about evidence-based policy often focuses on the policy side. The questions we ask are often along the lines of, why is this amazing body of evidence not already shaping policy? But what we should also be asking on the research side is whether the evidence base itself is actually worthy of shaping policy. Joining me today is Rafe Meagher, who is an associate professor at the University of New South Wales and is one of the leading meta-analysts, if that's a word, in economics. Rafe is here to explain why the evidence base is messier and more uncertain than we would like, and how we can fix that by aggregating across studies. Rafe, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
I want to start by establishing what a single paper even entails. Could you walk us through the chain from a researcher who's sat at their desk when the light bulb goes off and they have an idea, all the way to the final version of a paper being published in an economics journal? What does that research journey typically look like?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of like heterogeneity even in that. So establishing like the theme very early of like everything is heterogeneous. But I think what it might surprise people or people don't realize is like research projects have this like very big front end thinking cost, where like you're kind of wandering around, thinking about an area, accumulating information, accumulating background. Ideally, you know, this is, I think, kind of ideal. You're kind of accumulating background knowledge, you're accumulating understanding, you're accumulating insight about what kinds of data might be available or what kinds of like techniques might be appropriate or available to answer the question you're interested in. And then at a certain point, like, something will kind of like hit, and there's like a spark kind of feel. Most researchers I've talked to describe this feeling of like you suddenly get this sort of feeling of like a connection being made, which is really exciting, and but like is the start usually of like a 5-year process of trying to like follow that. And like, you know, there's a lot of iteration and stopping and starting, so you know, you get to very quickly you realize like, oh, the way I'm even thinking about the outcome that I'm interested in is not highly developed enough, and I have to think about like, okay, most things you're interested in are flow variables, actually not stock variables, and like for what time period. So there's like this incredible amount of detail and kind of complexity that's like uncovered as you go. And then fortunately, like there's constraints on the process where you have to publish at some point, and you have to, you know, share what you've learned, because, you know, even if you're now the person that knows the most about what it is that you've been working on, that doesn't mean you're best placed to like make the next deductive leap or inductive leap or whatever a philosopher would say. So I think, you know, at that point, that's when you start showing it to other people in the form of like a working paper or a series of talks, and eventually trying to kind of get it past expert referees. Ideally, again, like there's lots of things that are not ideal in that process, and ways that it doesn't work the way it should, but it also sometimes does work the way it should, and you should be able to convince like 3 or 10 other experts in your field that, you know, what you've done is kind of new and like plausibly true and also of kind of importance or like relevance to anyone. So that's sort of the three things that I tell students, and I also like check myself as well. Like, research is not like policy. Like, it has to be new, but as we probably will discuss, like a lot of stuff is new that doesn't feel new or seem new, and part of the life, I guess, of a researcher is like learning that and figuring that out.
Yeah. And then if we think about the end of that process, when a paper finally kind of lands in a journal, I guess that typically means, especially nowadays, that the reviewers believe the causal claim being made. I guess that is more specific to microeconomics, but if we're talking about development economics, which we do on this podcast, then we probably are talking about micro. I think a lot of policymakers will then read the the key takeaway from the paper, something like this study shows X, and assume that that means something stronger than it does. Could you talk us through what those types of statements you might see in an abstract or on Twitter typically show exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is a huge kind of can of worms. When you're kind of at that point, the idea is that other experts in your field believe whatever the central claims of the paper are. It doesn't necessarily have to be causal, even in micro. Like, aggregation results are not necessarily causal. They're more about how much variation is in something. Certainly our aspiration would be that the result is useful to a policy person. But with that said, I think there's kind of, it's not right to think about papers as proving that something is happening or not happening or true or not true. And unfortunately, you do see people, like in the commentary and also in the policy spaces and even in academic spaces, talking like, a paper is like equivalent to some sort of like mathematical proof. That's definitely the wrong way to think about it. Like, empirical social science is about kind of the balance of probabilities type of stuff. Like, there's an accumulation of evidence, you know, for or against a certain kind of narrow proposition, if you're making some narrow claim. But of course, in fact, we're always dealing with a somewhat broader claim than we would, you know, perhaps in a perfect world like to make, although, you know, it's weird to think of a perfect world as being kind of very narrow. And with that said, also, like, math proofs also are only applicable in certain circumstances. So, you know, even saying like, oh, it's not a math proof, like, you know, the axioms of the proof have to hold for the proof to be relevant. And, you know, in theory, some of those axioms are actually empirical claims about like data objects and statistics. And so at minimum, even if you have like a theoretical proof of something, like say errors and possibility theorem, which is one of the most important papers ever written in social science, you still have to ask yourself, like, oh, is the setup of this theorem like a good description of the situation that I'm thinking I'm going to apply the theorem to? And then, like, what does a good description entail? Totally subjective, fuzzy, like, and again, I think there's no way to get around that, and nor would we actually want to. Like, I think none of us would actually want to live in a world where you could, like, nail every single thing down and standardize it. And, like, so, I mean, it's kind of, we don't live in that world, but I think we also wouldn't want to. And, you know, we wouldn't also want to make policy from that wish either. Like, I think there's a sense in which if you do statistics enough, you come to, like, respect, like, the noise. You come to respect, like, what's not capturable as something kind of important alongside, like, what we're very happy that we can capture and explain, I would say.
And if a paper is well designed, well executed, what are the statistical reasons the results might still be misleading?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, the way that economists in particular taught to think about like what was called internal validity, is itself excessively narrow. And in fact, in kind of the more basic undergrad textbooks, some of the definitions are wrong or not defensible, let's say. So they would say, oh, you know, it would have to be an unbiased estimator. Like, that's not a good restriction to place on a problem. Like, we know that standard estimators in instrumental variables are not unbiased, but they're still useful, blah, blah, blah. But so even if you had kind of everything that a basic textbook would tell you you need to have for internal validity, there's lots of stuff that's outside of the kind of framework that classical econometrics is set up in. So the one that, like, I think should be on people's mind more is about precision or variance or power. So there's just very little serious attempt to deal with noise. And people do these power calculations that are mostly, to be honest, made up or kind of reverse engineered. And, you know, we wouldn't accept that in other areas of our statistical practice. you know, we wouldn't accept like a hand wavy justification for the consistency of an estimator, or for the like causal identification strategy. And yet when it comes to power, precision, and noise, that's kind of like a secondary concern, which I think, you know, is really a shame. The other thing I think that is missing, and that, you know, hopefully this could change. I mean, hopefully all of what we're saying could change, is that, you know, each paper and each result actually occurs in a context. And not just in the sense that like every policy is tested in a, you know, particular place and time, but also like the existing knowledge that we have about the policy or the idea informs the way that study is run. And you can do the absolute best job given the existing knowledge that you have. And yet if that existing knowledge is wrong, the study might still be misleading in a way that like no one could know unless they had, you know, insight into, and sometimes policymakers do have insight, like, you know, actually, I know this is not applicable because I know, you know, this or that other information about the local context that I'm working in. And so I think that's really important, just as much as like, you know, rigorous evidence is obviously extremely important, and that nothing can kind of take away from that.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to it there in terms of how evidence or results from one study travel to another place or another context. I guess we've just discussed internal validity. This touches on external validity. Could you explain what that term actually means and why it's a central problem when we're thinking about the usefulness of evidence?
Absolutely. So external validity, which is also sometimes called generalizability, or in other literatures it's called transportability, is a kind of broad concern that the kind of results or insights that I'm learning in a specific paper or context or study may be not perfectly or perhaps very not relevant to situations outside of that which I've studied. So formally speaking, in statistics, like classical inference is very narrow. There's like you're supposed to be drawing from a particular population. You need to know something about the drawing process. Ideally, you're hoping that it's like this perfectly random type of independent sampling, but you can do fine even if it's not, as long as you know. But the issue is like, there is actually no, this like idea of a population, especially in social science. Again, this goes back to like, these things are always flowing. Like there's no population of like adults in the UK. You know, that's changing every single day because people are moving in and out of the population. And that's generically true in social science. And so you always have, like, even if you're only thinking about past to future, you always have, in fact, an extrapolation error that is not captured in classical stats or econometrics. So that's the central challenge of external validity. Even the most narrowly defined kind of version of it. And then, of course, you can go even bigger and say, like, all sorts of stuff is changing. That stuff might be important. Or just, like, perhaps more broadly and more relevant to development, which I think is a very important application of this set of issues, which is, you know, if I'm trying to make development policy, if I'm the World Bank, or if I'm, you know, like an aid agency in Europe or Australia or, you know, in Africa itself, I am hoping that I can make kind of general policies that are going to be applicable across a broad range of places, so that, you know, the kind of hope of kind of policy making as a concept is that there might be something more than like a totally tailored solution to every single situation, right? Because that's just what is a personal solution. So the idea of like there being society that enacts a policy is an aggregating idea. And in development, I think it's right to have the aspiration to go further and say, like, you know, if something works really well, you know, in Kenya, might it not also work in countries that have some similarity to Kenya? Now, the answer could be no, but the answer could also be yes. So actually, when I started like working on aggregation. You know, and that was partially kind of motivated by the fact that economists and policy people would kind of do one study or see one study and say like, oh, this is great because now I know, you know, okay, I got a zero on the microcredit here. That means it doesn't work anywhere. Or I got a positive effect, you know, of cash transfers. So that means I should roll it out in every country. You're like, you know, that probably is not a good idea, but that doesn't mean that it's not the case that it would work everywhere. It might, but we don't actually have evidence to suggest that yet. And so I don't think it's right to be like pessimistic, as I think many kind of critics of, you know, economics or whatever become pessimistic and say like, you know, it's ridiculous to think that the same thing could work in Kenya as could work in Ghana. You're like, that's actually not ridiculous at all. It may or may not be true. And we have the capacity to study that and we should.
Yeah, and your research on microfinance, I guess, is like a important demonstration of this in action. There had been 7 RCTs. There was disagreement on the estimated effects between these different studies. How exactly did you look into these questions? What methods were you using? How do they work? And then what did you find?
The central issue that you have when you're trying to assess how different a bunch of estimates are across different settings. That's a question about like what would be the extrapolation error if I claimed that the effect in Kenya is the same as the effect in Ghana. But if I do the study again in Kenya, I'm going to get a different estimate because there's sampling error. That's the nature of empirical statistical work. And so, you know, just the fact that I see a different estimate in Ghana to Kenya does not tell me that actually the effects are different. And it doesn't, in fact, on a pretty kind of sensible set of assumptions, that's going to be an overestimate of the difference because of the sampling error. So what you need is a statistical technique that can separate those two sources of error. And what's hard about this is that in most cases, we think that the errors are multiplying each other. And so what that means is you can't use like a simple technique that you would learn kind of in Stat 101, like a, you know, regression type techniques or additive techniques not going to work. So you need something that for any like technical listeners in the audience performs a deconvolution, which is a need that, you know, people face across science. Like these techniques are used in astrophysics. And there's a variety of ways you can do it. But the one that I used, which I think is really applicable and promising and was used in political science for a long time, has been used in other fields, is called Bayesian hierarchical modeling. So basically a hierarchical model allows you to specify like these nested types of parameters and uncertainty associated with them. So to say like, okay, I have uncertainty just within Kenya about what the effect is. But then when I'm trying to say like, okay, what's the average effect across, you know, in the microcredit case, it was not Kenya and Ghana, but it was, you know, Morocco and Ethiopia and, you know. So then the question is, okay, there's also a set of errors or uncertainties associated with trying to do inference across the settings, not just within the settings. And so you want to build a second layer of the model. And that creates a hierarchy of errors, or a hierarchy of uncertainties would be perhaps a better way to say it. And then you'd be interested in not just the average effect of your microcredit expansion in the case that I was looking at, but also what is that variation? And we can actually estimate that. But the challenge is that very rarely will we have a very large number of these evaluations. Or these studies. So I think one of the issues is that because people are familiar with like classical frequentist statistics, which sort of leans on cases where you have a lot of data, people have this feeling like, well, to do meta-analysis, I need lots and lots of estimates. And it's true that, you know, the kind of classical set of ways that people do meta-analysis and aggregation are going to perform better when you have lots and lots of estimates. However, the problem is that when you start thinking seriously about, okay, what is the actual intervention that I'm or policy question that I'm interested in? There's usually actually not that many studies that indeed address that question. So for example, there's a large literature on like what goes on when you do microcredit, but a lot of the literature is about changing the like contract that you're offering, or you know, the researcher is kind of subsidizing certain aspects of the microcredit operation, or they're looking to change certain ways that they structure the loan or whatever, or the interaction. And those are actually fundamentally different questions than the question that I was interested in, which is like, what just happens if you just expand access? Like, should you support existing microcredit people to just roll out their product more? Should we have more of whatever this is? Is that like a good funding priority? And there's actually not that many studies that just do that. And when you're dealing with a small number of data points at that context level, you want to use Bayesian techniques, which don't rely on these large sample approximations. You can use them with large sample approximations. They require you to put more structure onto the problem because you're not going to be necessarily relying on that large sample assumption. But you know, the large sample assumption is not tenable if you want to keep a strict eye on like what is the actual intervention that I'm trying to study. And so I think it's a really worthwhile trade-off.
So suppose there's a program which is found to work or succeed across a number of pilot RCTs, which is quite commonly done by governments and also aid agencies. And then after those pilots, you've seen that it works. The government then decides to scale it nationally. Could you talk us through some of the reasons why, when implemented at scale, we might not see the same effects that we did in the pilots?
There's a huge number of reasons why this could happen. And I think there's a variety of kind of categories of reasons here. So, you know, if you're thinking about kind of econ degree set of reasons, there's this partial equilibrium versus general equilibrium stuff. And there's a lot of people working on this now, sort of related to this idea of spillovers, which is, you know, when a program is really small, it's probably not going to have major spillovers. It's not going to move, you know, prices or stuff in the macroeconomy. But if you scale that up to like an enormous chunk of the people in your economy, that actually can move prices and have spillovers and stuff like that. So that's one kind of concern. And I think there's some suggestion that things like that also happen because there may not be a supply of the inputs that you need. So there's been some discussion in the literature on like class sizes, where initially there was this literature where it seemed like having smaller class sizes is really, you know, on average, very good for children's learning. And then some of the larger studies seemed like that was not borne out. And then it seemed that when they actually talked to people, they said, well, there's not a supply of good trained teachers. So like, you know, we can hire more teachers to make smaller class sizes, but the, you know, we don't have the same quality as we're hiring more and more. So that's the kind of general sort of macro type set of concerns or supply set of concerns. I think the other, there's a kind of statistical set of concerns about like, you know, pilots are small by nature. You know, the kind of challenges are always greater when you're doing inference on small samples. Even if you do Bayes, which I surely think you should, and you do it the best that you can, and you use all the contextual information that you have, all the expert opinion to make the best priors possible. And we've done work like that. I've done that in collaboration with David McKenzie and Alia Iacovone at the World Bank. And we think that's really promising. But at the end of the day, like you still, it's still a small sample. And so you still, you know, need to be aware that when you're scaling up, things might look different because you're going to have uncertainty when you're dealing with a small number of things. Now, that is related to the fact that when you're doing a pilot, often you're kind of watching it like a hawk, like you are monitoring what's happening. You are checking that it's being implemented. Now, not perhaps as much as like you would like to in a perfect world, but still much more than you're going to be able to when you scale it up. And so I think there's this third set of concerns where there's actually like a kind of implementation chunk of the intervention that is meaningfully tied to the success or failure of the intervention, and yet is often kind of overlooked. And I think systematic differences in what implementation will look like at scale that mean that, like, it's plausible that we could end up like studying that, and we've tried to do a little bit of that. But there's, I think, a lot more that can be done for that type of potential surprises or uncertainty.
Yeah, and your research with Noam Angris does look at that kind of implementation factor in education. And I guess what you find is that in the studies that you're comparing, it seems like implementation is explaining quite a lot of the variation that was present across the different studies. I was wondering, yeah, if you could talk us through that work with Noam, what exactly you were comparing, and then what you found.
This is work that was kind of a big surprise to me, because I was used to dealing with, or like I had thought a lot about these very narrow circumstances where, you know, in the microcredit work, these are already established microfinance operators. They already operate at a big scale. The question is just, should they scale up even more? You know, they're already in these neighborhoods of, you know, Hyderabad. Should they go to even more neighborhoods? That's a really different question to when you're trying to start a completely new type of intervention. And, you know, you've only done it in a small number of schools, or, you know, you can only do it for a small number of companies in the case of the paper with the World Bank. So, you know, the paper with Noam got started because, you know, they were in the process of scaling up throughout Botswana, and they kind of knew that there was a good chance they would get to also operate in Namibia and South Africa, which has now indeed come to pass. And they knew that they were likely to need to change aspects of how they were operating at scale. But what they didn't know is, like, which are the aspects that have to be preserved in order for our success to continue? Because they were doing pretty rigorous, like, evaluation and checking of their own performance and their own kind of value added and the test scores of the kids. I should say this is with Youth Impact. So that's the organization that the wonderful people that Noam works with in Botswana have kind of, and they really were not sure, like, what are the features that are essential for us to preserve when we're implementing at scale, and what features, you know, are perhaps not as important and we can afford to compromise without risking the integrity of, like, the success and the learning that we've been able to deliver. So when I started talking to them about this, I tried to make it clear, like, we're not going to be able to answer that question, like, causally using these aggregation methods. But what we can do is, if we have data on a bunch of different interventions that are similar enough to what Youth Impact does, in the sense that they do this targeted instruction, then we can start to look at which features of these interventions are most highly correlated with larger treatment effects. And that would give us a sense of, like, where to look if you start thinking about varying features of the implementation. So Noam had a strong idea that we should check the delivery mode, so volunteer delivery versus delivery by the teachers that are already in the school. And then there's various other measures of implementation. So the first that Noam thought were important that turned out indeed to be important. So the first one is take up. So just, like, if economists think about take up as, like, did the target audience receive the treatment? But as kind of we were talking about in the beginning of the conversation, actual take up is way more complicated than that. Like, if you think about delivering, like, remedial targeted educational instruction, you know, going to one of these classes, you really think that probably not going to do that much. But if you go to the whole sequence of courses over 8 weeks, you'd think that could really do a lot. So then the question is, like, how much of the stuff do I need to, how many classes do I need to go to before I got the treatment? And how many of the students and how many of the classes? So that's one issue with take up itself is not a simple binary variable per person. But moreover, you know, targeted instruction is not that easy to deliver. Even if the students are there all the time, because you have to assess their level, then you have to split them up. Then you have to like actually teach them at their level, which anybody that's like tried to teach people anything or manage a classroom would know is very difficult to do. And so it's just really plausible that like the training of these teachers or volunteers makes a big difference. And so it did end up being the case. And I personally was really surprised that these measures of kind of implementation, also the extent of implementation fidelity turned out to be very strongly predictive of the size of the treatment effects. And that was also corroborated when Noam and his team started varying, for example, the amount of targeting. So asking their implementers to target even more and split even more, would that in fact lead to more gains in learning? And the answer was yes. And so that was really satisfying. Obviously, there's lots more to kind of do and think about in terms of implementation. But I think as a kind of first pass sniff test of like, is it the case that we can use like correlations that we find in the aggregate to guide careful tests or piloting about what can we change when we scale up? I think that is a feasible workflow, and I think that has a lot of promise.
Yeah, and then I guess if we're thinking about that result, that there's a lot of variation in the kind of estimated effects across studies because of different implementation factors or different kind of things that fall into that bucket. I guess from a policymaker's perspective, instead of asking, does this program work? The right question could be, can my system actually deliver this program? Is that how you would frame it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And I think on the one level, maybe it sounds obvious that people should have been thinking about that, like what's actually feasible to deliver. But the truth is that people don't think about it that way, and not just in policy, but also academics. So something that really shocked me when Noam and I started working on this is how many academics really thought this can't be a big deal. Like, and in fact, the reason they thought that is because they said, well, maybe it's true in the world that implementation is not so good sometimes or often, you know, and that compromises the delivery of the policy. But surely that's not going to be true in the randomized trials. That's not going to be true in the studies. Like all the studies are gold-plated. That's the critique. And so the idea is like, you know, everybody's trying really hard to implement perfectly in the study. So, you know, you're not going to find meaningful variation in implementation. And even if there is variation in implementation, it probably won't matter. So that was not correct at all. Again, like basic contact with reality tells you that like, despite your best efforts, you usually don't get things perfect. And in fact, like, it's not just that you usually don't get them perfect. Like, you're barely getting them over the line a lot of the time, even when you really try. And that is as true when like a bunch of smart people are trying really hard as in any other, you know, situation, which I think is a blow to the ego of the smart people. But, you know, you've got to remember, like, you're doing something ambitious. So, like, you know, you should expect that there is going to be implementation challenges no matter how hard you try. And so I'm really, you know, hopeful that by doing more of this type of work, we can kind of systematize the understanding of like, it's not a given that just because you say, you know, let's roll out the program in, you know, the Okavango Delta, and here's a check that I write, you know, and I'm the minister of government or whatever, you know, that does not mean that it's going to happen. And so thinking much more seriously about what does it take to get implementation to work? The other critique that people had is they were like, okay, maybe it's true that implementation varies despite your best efforts, but you know, everyone's trying really hard. And so like, you can't improve it. You can't systematically intervene in implementation itself. And I think that was a reasonable critique, but also turned out not to be true, right? The way Youth Impact is implementing, and I went out to the field and also saw it myself, which is like kind of something I learned from my advisor as to Duflo, to always do that, even if you're just the statistician. You know, you can see how good they are at implementation, and yet even so, there actually is room for systematic improvement and systematic variation. And so this thing can be studied in a scientific way, which I think is like good news.
I guess in this episode so far, we've been talking about a lot of the benefits of aggregation, but I was wondering if we could take a moment to think about what meta-analysis methods are not able to solve and where we are still kind of stuck.
Very, very good question. There will never be like a solution to every problem. So there's various issues that arise at different stages of the pipeline. I guess I talked in my previous answer about how there was a concern that because RCTs are like gold-plated in people's minds, that therefore, you know, implementation would be changeable. And that turned out not to be true, but it's still, you know, a plausible circumstance that places where you can do more rigorous assessments or more rigorous evaluations are different to places where you can't. And so, you know, there's all sorts of selection bias you could think about as a type of site selection bias. Various people have worked on this, but there hasn't been a satisfactory solution. So, you know, the way we think about selection bias has a kind of history coming up through these like Heckman models and then into instrumental variables approaches. And with the small number of interventions, it's pretty hard going to get much traction. So I think there's a lot of work still to be done on mapping out like what is the selection of how do studies get run? Like how does research actually happen? Because as we're talking about like, you know, it's not a scientific process of like selection of what research you work on. It's very artistic. But I think then there's also these issues of like publication bias, kind of the research community has certain things that it wants to see or doesn't want to see, which may or may not be connected to what the truth is. There's always issues with that. And there's lots of good people working on this, but it is really tough. So, you know, there was this push in the literature of like, oh, there's a replication crisis. Now there's some more, or I mean, across the sciences. Now there's been more kind of research kind of broadening the perspective and saying, what kind of replication did we expect given what we were doing and like the techniques that are being used, like what are the hypothesis tests and the p-values kind of delivering? Should we have expected this or that? So I think the truth is that there's like just a complexity to gaining knowledge in any method. In a sort of systematic scientific way or in like a policymaker specific context. So, you know, there's kind of leaky parts of our pipeline. There's leaky parts of the pipeline that you can gain knowledge through any other method in. And so I think that ultimately speaks to like an interdisciplinary push and also like collaboration between policymakers and academics. So I don't think either group would want to do without the other as much as each of us might sometimes like feel that way. I think it is a case where like more is more and each, you know, type of evidence or knowledge about something kind of brings kind of more to the table.
And if we're trying to pull all of the different themes and stats that we've discussed today together for someone in the policy world, I guess it'd be interesting to hear from you when you see a single paper with a causal claim, whether it's on social media or an abstract in a newsletter, how do you respond? And do you have any kind of rules of thumb to think that through quickly in your head in terms of how much you believe it, what might some of the issues be, etc.?
Yeah, so I do have some like heuristics I use myself. So, I mean, unsurprisingly, the first one is like, you know, it's always better to have more than one study. So, you know, if you've got the first study on, you know, the topic and there's nothing even remotely related to it, you have to be cautious about interpreting what it means. So it's always better if you can have multiple studies of similar phenomena, or the same phenomena, or whatever. That's always much better. Of course, there's always a question I'm thinking about of like the quality of the study, you know, the quality of like the causal or statistical techniques that are used. Something else that I always look for is whether the study is pre-registered or if there's a pre-analysis plan. And then I would go and actually look at the pre-analysis plan if I could, because those are really informative and certainly helps me to understand the context in which that study and the knowledge is produced. The other thing I would do is like, perhaps further down the line, if I was thinking that I did want to kind of use the information and perhaps it is only a single study or even with multiple studies, I would also ask other people that have more knowledge in the area than what I have. So, you know, I might see a paper that I think, oh, it's really convincing, but it's got a public health aspect that I'm going to ask people that I know in public health, like, does this pass your stiff test? Or, you know, I have a lot more kind of contact with academic psychologists now, which has been really interesting. And so, you know, that means that I might have a reaction perhaps against something in academic psychology, but I can go to academic psychologists and say, okay, you know, tell me what's really going on here, or what your view is. So I think always trying to seek out the view of other people that might have bits of knowledge that you're missing, I think is a like really helpful tip.
If we're looking forward a couple of years, I was wondering if you could tell us how you see this area playing out or evolving. Because it seems like there is a growing movement towards aggregation. And then we've also got AI now, which is going to increase the number of individual studies massively, potentially in the next couple of years, which I guess makes the need for aggregation even more important for policymakers and also the general public, just to help them kind of make sense of the onslaught of papers. I think even right now or a couple of years ago, leaving aside the AI aspect, policymakers really struggled to piece together papers and understand what they should be taking away, given that there's so many development economics papers out there. And I guess that problem is probably set to get worse. So what are you looking out for? And do you think there's anything that should be getting more attention in this space?
Yeah, it's sort of hard to know what will happen, but I can tell you like what I think would be important to keep in mind and hopefully will kind of shape the way people think about it. So I think as the kind of costs of certain parts of the research process go down, you have to expect that there'll be some more research coming out. I don't know how much more. But I think if it's the case that there's this massive increase in the studies, I think that makes it more important to think really seriously when we're doing aggregation about the quality of the inputs and exactly what is it that the study is delivering and able to estimate. And kind of being disciplined in a sense and only aggregating, what is kind of conceptually coherent or what is able to answer the research question that it purports to answer. I do think that aggregation and this type of like meta research will become more important in the next 20 years, 10 years. My hope is that we're going to get more methodological work. So I think the challenge is that, you know, people that are not familiar with aggregation or meta-analysis or whatever think that, well, look, there's this Cochrane handbook in medicine that tell you do meta-analysis. People in other fields even sometimes will say it's like an easy publication. You always have to be very wary of that. And, you know, if that's how people are thinking about it, if they're thinking about this like cookbook, cookie cutter type of thing, then things could be really bad because you've got this like rote application of statistical techniques without thinking about whether they're applicable and without really like careful kind of scientific assessment of like, what is the causal estimand or what is the estimand that we're interested in? How do these bodies of evidence combine in order to get us to that? But I'm really hopeful that economics can work with other social sciences. So I mentioned psychology, but also public health, et cetera, to feed back into this idea of like aggregation's not an easy problem. So in fact, there's like lots of formal work in macroeconomics about like aggregation paradoxes and aggregation problems. And those are just as relevant when you're aggregating evidence as when you're trying to make, you know, policy aggregation over preferences and stuff like that. So I'm really hopeful that economists will have a lot to contribute here to what I think will be an interdisciplinary effort to try to sort through evidentiary quality. And my kind of extra hope is that the public could start to think and be informed about the different quality levels of evidence, because I think we have a problem right now where, you know, the public is rightly getting fed up with this idea of like, oh, studies say this or that, and it's all contradictory, and they're not given the kind of tools to understand, like, there's real variation in quality of studies, just like there is in like football teams, right? Like, so I think it's not a hard concept to say, like, there's a group of people that are doing activity X, in this case, research, could be anything, and some of it's better than others. And so, you know, we need to think of ways that we can systematize that, communicate that to each other, as well as to the public and the policymakers who need to use that information.
Great. Well, Rafe, thanks again for joining. This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our Substack. And all of our past episodes, as ever, are also available at voxdev.org.